It takes courage and belief in yourself and your business idea to take the step to set up your own business. In the early stages, entrepreneurship can be a lonely road, even through those milestone moments. Deciding to commit to the idea you've been mulling over, learning, growing, and developing your skills, building a team to help you along the way, preparing to launch into new markets. Enterprise Ireland is there for all of those startup moments. From providing advice and guidance to new founders through our startup network, to pre-seed funding and early investment, we're here to help bring your ambition to fruition. To find out how Enterprise Ireland can help you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Time's running out. Windows 10 support ends this October. That means no updates, no more security patches. That is a major risk for you and your business. But Nostra is helping you and your business upgrade. Book your free consultancy call. Simply click the link in the description below the podcast episode. Before we dive into today's episode, I want to share a game changer for your business, Azure Communications. When it comes to print and marketing solutions, these folks, led by CEO Jenny Johnston, are the real deal. Whether you need an eye-catching brochure, sleek business cards, or a full-blown digital campaign, Azure Communications has you covered. They're not just about high-quality prints or digital campaigns, they're also about delivering great results. And here's the best part. Just for listeners of The Entrepreneur Experiment, you can get 20% off your first order. Just give them a call or go online and use the code FOX20. With personalized service and fast turnaround times, Azure Communications will help you make the impact your business deserves. Trust me, when it comes to making your brand stand out, Azure Communications is the provider of choice. Check them out at azurecom.ie. Use code FOX20 and elevate your marketing game today.
Timo, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure.
I think we're kindred spirits. We're going to get on real well. Health freaks, food freaks. We're going to talk about longevity and barely get to talk about business.
Love it. Love it. Perfect.
How are you?
Good. Great morning.
Welcome. Exercise. Welcome to Dublin.
Thank you.
You're a regular now, I think.
I am. I've been coming here for the last 12 years. Holidaying, friends, weddings. It's a huge privilege to now have a business here. You know, got a great team. We just launched Gusto here in all of Ireland, available now. We've been live for 14 weeks. It's the early days, the grind. I've done this game for 13 years. It's fun to go back.
You kind of get to scratch that entrepreneur itch all the time with new markets. You're like, right, into the grind. We've been here before. It's probably quite grueling. How many markets are you in now?
Two. Okay. We've done the UK for 13 years and now we're in Ireland.
Amazing.
So we're excited.
So that's your second market. Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Why Ireland?
I mean, look, it's such a rich kind of food culture. In the UK, we eat, you know, we proudly eat Irish beef, Irish produce. There's so much great produce in this country. Such a tradition. People love their food. They're, you know, the way they've cooked for a long time. But equally, people, just like in the UK, focus on convenience, but without compromise. You know, on, they don't want to compromise on budget, on taste, on quality. And so we really want to cater to the masses, not the classes. We want to make families' lives easier, healthier, better, more togetherness. So you can kind of fuel your body with stuff that's actually good for you from the local farm, local produce, but, you know, cutting down on the time it takes. And so we send you all the ingredients. You choose whatever you like. You just have to cook. You know, anyone can do it. You don't have to be amazing. But instead of buying the jar of, you know, whatever spice and then chucking it away, you just get exactly what you need. You know, there's no food waste. CO2 emissions are lower. It's healthier. And so that's kind of what we're trying to achieve here.
It's one of the things that just makes sense, right? I love that line. Convenience without compromise. I'm going to steal that off you.
Nice.
It's a good one. But it just makes sense, right? We're all kind of like, and I like that, convenience without compromise, because people are very binary about this. They're like, oh, I'd eat healthy, but I'd go to the gym, but you're like, you can do all these things. You don't have to compromise one or the other. It can be, you know, cut down your screen time. You can just have a little bit of more planning.
But it's hard.
It is hard, but it's companies like yours that make the difference. Going, it's this is how you plan it. Yeah. So where did this all start?
So going back by a long time, I went to high school in the US in Napa Valley, very lucky for 1 year as an exchange student.
Okay.
And my godparents, not by blood related, but somehow ended up to be my godparents. They live in California. They got me to come when I was 16, 17. And they're food entrepreneurs, and they built an organic vineyard, organic supermarket, ice cream place. Never raised money, no boards, no VC funds, tiny operations. Half the stuff failed. But when I was 16, 17, coming from Germany, you know, seeing my dad slaving away in a corporate, working really long hours, really hard, and then suddenly seeing these can-do, hyper-optimistic entrepreneurs, you know, a couple, and they just, you know, have this can-do attitude. And it's been amazing for me, and amazingly inspirational. I love food. I love cooking. I hate food waste. I went into banking and finance, as one did in 2007. I was good at math. I like numbers. So applied for banking, but didn't enjoy the purpose. You know, there was a lack of purpose. I didn't see my future in banking. The people were great, but, you know, everyone worked 100 hours. It wasn't focused on culture, getting the best out of people. It was kind of very financially minded.
Was this in London?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that... You hear about it, those 100-hour weeks, hustling, grafting. Is that real?
Yeah, very much. I mean, back in the days, I can't comment on today, but I mean, back in the day, absolutely insane. You know, you'd sit in the office until the wee hours, and then next day you come back at 7 a.m., do it again, walk across the bridge. You know, I lived Bank Station, walked across the bridge, slept, walked back, office, walked back, slept. Repeat, rinse, insane. And I just didn't see the purpose, didn't enjoy it that much. I gained a great kind of toolbox of skills. And then my godparents kept on pushing me, like, why are you in finance? Why are you not following your passion for food? Set up a business, you know, don't waste your life. You can always get a job. You know, you don't have a kids or mortgage. And so I did when I was 26, following my passion.
I love that. And you need those people in your life.
Yeah,
you need those in spirit. I said it to you outside. You have to see it to be it. You need those people who are showing you another way, because there's loads of people that'll tell you to, like, get a safe job, have a career, blah, blah, blah. So what was the moment? I'm always curious about the 0 to 1 moment. What was your 0 to 1 where you're like, yeah, I'm just going to go for it?
I think, you know, it dawned up on me that the risk is actually really small. Sure, I'm going from a high-paying job to no income, and that's a huge motivator. But at the end of the day, if this fails, I learn how to cook. I learn about entrepreneurship, and so the risk is actually tiny. Moved back into student accommodation, tiny place, had to lower my cash burn, live on nothing, didn't pay myself an income for the first couple of years. You know, and then I slowly saw this kind of work, but it took a couple of years, and it's been the grind to find product market fit.
What was the moment where you're like, I have to do it? Not like, I should do it, I have to do it.
We traveled to Italy, and I did a cooking class with all my mates in Italy. Like, we were like 15 guys, great fun, Alba, truffle season in autumn, insane food. And I just realized I love food so much. If I don't do this, I will regret this forever. If I do it and it fails, I mean, who cares, right? I'm 26. No one depends on me. Who cares? And so I just went all in. And it then took me maybe like 4 or 5 months from that kind of point of, yeah, I have to do it, to actually quitting my job and launching the day after quitting my job.
And how did you go from, I want to do something in food, to like, this is the idea?
So, I goofed around a lot back then. I kind of had this dream of getting a big property and creating this beautiful experience where you walk in and you see a recipe station. Everything is black, beautifully designed, and you choose whatever kind of you like. And the recipe card tells you which ingredients to pick, but you can smell, you can choose, you can touch. And then I realized how expensive property is. I was very naive. I realized, you know, if you fail as a director of that property business, I mean, you know, you're not getting a loan, or you can't start another business easily, and so on. And then I realized, like, how fast online is growing. Buying food online wasn't common back then. Buying food in a box wasn't common. And so there were lots of hurdles, but I just got excited, you know, health, sustainability, convenience, where and are the mega trends in this market. And so Gusto is ticking all these three boxes: more sustainable, more healthy, more convenient. And so we saw this mega wave, but it took me, you know, 4 months to figure out like it shouldn't be a shop.
Okay. So you kind of like, you kind of whiteboarded out all the different ideas. You kind of started with what you'd love to do and then just kind of tweet and looked at like the mega trends, what was kind of prevailing, where you believe the market would go.
The piece you're missing is that I actually spent half my time cooking stuff.
Okay.
And, you know, friends came by and thinking, oh my God, like, what are you doing? This makes no sense. You know,
but you were experimenting. Yeah, so I call this the entrepreneur experiment, because I believe business is just a series of thousands and millions of experiments just done over and over and over and over and over. That's why I love picking out the piece of the zero to one, because it's never the same. People are like, oh, what have they all got in common? How do you start a business? It's like a million different ways.
I was so naive. I didn't know anything about business. I didn't know entrepreneurs apart from my godparents. And so I literally cooked, you know, this like champagne prawn soup 50 times to perfect it. And I kind of felt like if I could come up with these crazy recipes, I would sell in a shop, in a physical shop. People would change the way they kind of cook and eat. And then, I stumbled up on the online trend and convenience, and I changed the plan. But so much in hindsight, you know, it felt like I was wasting so much time. But I think you need that serendipity, osmosis.
But you need to pursue, because it's impossible to plan everything. You can't, because the plan doesn't exist. There is no template. Every business created is totally different. Like, you are pursuing your passion. And I think there's it's really underrated, because like people, you know, people tell that generic, follow your passion. But specifically, you are just going, I'm going to cook and I'm going to figure it out. Because you have to go down the rabbit hole. Because down the rabbit hole is where the gold is.
Yeah, and also I worked in a hedge fund back then, and I worked 100 hours. And, you know, we had a 9 p.m. Sunday pre-market opening call.
Wow.
I had to be in the office by 7 a.m. So before I actually quit my job, I had no business plan, no spreadsheet, no like elaborate idea. I just needed to quit my job and then the next day fully commit, making soup back at home in my tiny flat. And I needed that time.
So how did you take the first steps then with Gusto? Because like it's a huge business now, right? So walk me backwards. Like, how do you go from here to there? Like, what were the first kind of couple of steps? What did you experiment with to kind of go, online's going to be big, I'd love to cut down on food waste, I'd love to give people high quality food? What was the kind of thesis you were trying to prove?
I mean, I think the vision back then was, and still today, was to be the most loved way to eat dinner. And so love, highly emotional, food is personal, what you eat is not what I eat. And so we had to really kind of personalize and customize and find a way that resonates with people. And then, you know, the purpose was to build a product that has a positive impact on people and the planet. And so from the early days, we tried to work on something that takes CO2 emissions out, no food waste, you know, groceries wasting 40% of food. Every time you eat Gusto, 23% of CO2 emissions are taken out. Versus the equivalent supermarket shop. And so we tried to really get these basics right. Look, we had to launch a website. You know, all we could pay was this like contractor in the countryside on a physical server. He promised to put the physical server on a table in case there's flooding, you know, and we called him every day, have you done this? And he was hustling for us. And it was chaotic. You know, all we could afford were a bunch of interns. We rented this tiny space where we would literally in the office, one person all day would cook recipes and shoot pictures on an iPhone. I would kind of do the recipe card design in PowerPoint, correcting the English and whatever. The fumes would go up. People were sitting on the mezzanine trying to create like flyers and stuff. We would repackage food in the office back in the early days. Complete insanity today, right?
But fish. They're the magic bits, right? Yeah, cooking fish in the office wouldn't make you popular. So that was your initial hypothesis was what you've kind of created today. You were like, right, we want to create healthy things that people can buy. So how did you start on your own? How did you get going? How did you get an office? How did you like take those first couple of baby steps?
So I convinced a friend of mine to join. I kind of founded myself, but then had a co-founder who joined a little bit later in the process. And then we convinced a bunch of unpaid interns to join this incredible rocket ship promising kind of equity and great career growth.
Free food.
It was really, really hard back then selling this. One of them actually has been with us for 13 years. Shout out to Aiden. I mean, amazing journey.
Very stars.
Seeing him grow.
Amazing.
Employee number three is still in the business. Really proud of these people. But yeah, we did everything. And, you know, we hand designed flyers. We handed out flyers every night at the train station to get some traction. We started knocking at doors. Everyone in the office a couple of days a week had to knock at people's doors. Really hard sell. Oh my God, you know, overcoming that hurdle to sell to people who don't want to really listen to you. We went to food markets every weekend, you know, grinding pesto, giving out samples of food to draw kind of attention to us. 10 hours every weekend plus like full on week. And then like slowly we got some traction. But I mean, we had, you know, initially we had like 5 customers, 12 customers. It took a long time to build that up to a meaningful number. And I hand delivered the boxes. I gave customers my phone number. I mean, literally everything. We packed. Once we had a bit more traction, we did a couple of like voucher deals, poor quality, but great for scale. But we ended up packing until like 7 a.m. in the morning in that office. We had to carve out the tables and chairs and everything to just pack, and all the interns had to pack. It was crazy. It was really bonding, and it's easy to romanticize and think, oh, this was so fun, but it was brutal.
But I think they're the things that get lost. There's a lot of hype online about like, oh, you know, scale, move fast, break things, all that nonsense. But they're the real stories of like, you have to do things that don't scale. You have to get your first 10 customers. You don't sit behind the desk just like running Instagram ads. You do it by grafting. You do it like all the best entrepreneurs I've spoken to who've just gone door to door, shop to shop, customer to customer, getting those. If you can get 10, you can get 100. If you get 100, you can get 1,000. That logic of like, you just have to start.
Completely. And I was so happy once we had the first 100. I went to people's homes and I gave them a share in the company, you know, in a frame to put on their wall. They probably like got rid of it. Now it's worth, you know, a few hundred pounds.
I was just
going to
say, that was an expensive mistake. Remember that guy? The guy used to come around on a Sunday, drops off food.
I was so grateful, you know, for people just trying. It was amazing back then.
So what was the evolution then? What was the first kind of like moment when you're on the way from like 10 to 100 where you're like, okay, this is going to work, but here's what we need to do?
I think, you know, once we had 100, you started to see patterns. This is working. This isn't working. If we only make XYZ better, we should see more traction. And I'm by nature a really optimistic person. And so I started to see the future based on the 100 customers we had. They gave us such rich feedback that would allow us to come up with this plan. You know, if we increase choice, if we cut down lead time, if we make the price point a bit more affordable because, you know, our cost base will come down as we scale. If we can change all these things, we can make the taste even better. You know, step by step by step, kind of the product got better. And we saw it in the numbers. Conversion rate went better. We started to see referral rate go up. And I think we learned that, you know, stating the obvious, but we learned that the higher your customer satisfaction, the more you see retention and referral rate grow and grow and grow. And so we started to obsess about this flywheel of high customer satisfaction, fighting for every customer, hustling to get it right. And then we just started to see them refer all their friends. And it was amazing to see.
Was referrals the big driver in the early stages?
Still is today. Yeah, huge amount of referrals.
If you were starting again in 2025 and you had to get 100 customers, what would you do?
Do the same again. I mean, you gotta hustle. I mean, maybe I would do more online marketing today versus back then, but you want to talk to customers. You want to get their feedback, their honest reaction. And, you know, I always remember handing out these flyers and some kind people would take 2 minutes and tell me why they wouldn't buy into this. And based on that feedback, the next person, I would just change my spiel and, you know, adjust in real time. And it was so valuable to get that instant feedback. Whereas if you just do A/B testing and you lose the noise and the signal.
The context.
Yeah,
the
it's feel, really important.
The facial expression.
So you got to talk to real people. Still today, right? We're a massive company now. but I still call customers and I want to know how they feel. We go visit customers to see how they use the product in their kitchen. And you get such like rich inspiration to then make the product better again.
I think that's so powerful because there's such a rush now towards like AI this, AI that. Don't worry, AI will do it. I'm kind of going, yeah, it will do a lot of stuff, but it won't do that. It won't go and like visit your customers from which for 6 years. Well, I love that. Go watch them in the kitchen. I had a pet shop retailer in a couple of weeks ago. Hugely successful. Shops all over Ireland. Massive success. Every Friday, gets in the car, does a tour of the shops. Mm. Every Friday. Like he has reached pinnacles of success beyond he ever thought possible. Mm. But every Friday, in the car, I was like, why do you do that? He's like, I want to see what people are buying. I want to see what way they're walking in the shop. I want to see what products they're selling. Why they're picking that up. I want to talk to them. I want to see them. I was like, but that's the passion, isn't it?
Yeah,
like that's the difference between like a good entrepreneur and a great entrepreneur. Great entrepreneur sweats the details and will stick with the customer. They're obsessed with the customer.
Yeah, and I see today's world focus on the competition way too much. You shouldn't care about the competition. You have to double down on the customer and the signal. What do customers want? Because, you know, ultimately, if I can make it better and better and better, I'll build the biggest business in Ireland. It's really simple. And if I can't deliver for customers, I'll fail. And so customer, customer, customer. I always like smile when these people come to me saying, here's the benchmarking. We looked at everyone. This is what we learned. Because benchmarks have like so much rubbish in them. If you want a benchmark, go to the best company in the world and like challenge yourself to be world class, but don't give me the average, right? I want to do the best I can do for my customers. And frankly, I really only care about what they tell me. Mm. But it's a big, you know, it's a big kind of stream of work to condition people to obsess about customers at scale.
Having standards, world-class standards. Yeah. That's what you want to get. So how, this sounds like an expensive business to build, right? As you're explaining this to me, I'm like,
it's a very insightful. Yeah.
Oh, it's why they pay me the big money, Timo. It just sounds like a hard business. There's certain businesses I'm sitting there going, oh, I'd like a bit of that. I think I could do that. Whereas I'm looking at this going, this sounds like a lot like hard work. How did you build this up? Because obviously a couple of free interns in the office hustling, but surely like there was a lot of volume in terms of like buying all the food, getting all the flyers, you know, fulfillment, shipping. How did you finance all this?
So I definitely feel like I played the game on hard modus for like 13 years now. And it's been like the hardest, fresh food, shipping it across the entire country, building supply chains, building AI. We have 17 AI products that power everything, physical factories, hundreds of people working in a physical cold environment, packing stuff, marketing teams, finance teams, you name it. You can't be good at two things. You have to be great at like seven things, whereas the world is telling you to double down on one thing. And so, yeah, it's about high standards. It's about really kind of embracing complexity. Now I see kind of the complexity, the vertical integration as our moat and our opportunity to like, you know, squeeze value for the customer and really deliver for the customer in a way no one else can. And so we have the world's kind of leading proposition in our space, the most choice, shortest lead time, best price point, but we really had to fight for this. And on the way to where we are now, you know, we had to raise hundreds of millions of pounds to make this a reality.
There we go.
That's the answer. It's a capital intense business.
Yeah. Like even as you're, there's loads of things I hadn't even thought of as you're listing them out there. I'm going, oh yeah, all the other side of stuff, like the cold units, the things like that. So at what point did you do your first raise?
I invested my life savings, you know, not much, but I managed to invest like £70,000 safe from working in finance. All I had left like the tiniest amount to just survive. And then we raised from friends and family. Back then, I didn't know a single VC fund. I didn't know what VC funds do. I didn't know professional angel investors. And so I had to convince friends, family, some people I knew from banking who had too much cash, invested 5K, 10K, small tickets. We raised 100K initially. And then we found these angels, CFO, COO of a massive food business. And they, after like 6 months of negotiation, invested 250K. And it felt like, you know, we made it. 250K, amazing. But most importantly, they brought so much knowledge to the operation, the supply chain. They literally looked at us saying, "Team," he always said, "Timo," in his accent, like, Timo, you're wasting so much money. Like, any idiot could give out free food on the street, right? You're not making any margin. This is stupid. And he really kind of got me to think differently about margin and supply chain. And initially, we just thought we just need traction and margin will come. And then we build it foundationally, right, with their help. And so they've been an amazing kind of influence on us, building this in a more positive way. Looking then 2 years in, we raised the first VC round, back then $1 million. And then we did, I think, $3 million shortly after.
Okay.
So it started to snowball at some point. Okay. But I mean,
is it like a feeding the monster? Is it like you're scaling and scaling and scaling, but as you scale, it needs more and more capital? And is it kind of like the flywheel and the opposite effect then as well?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, we're obsessed about unit economics. If we spent £1 on marketing, when would we see a return? What's the customer satisfaction? How many boxes would they buy? But yeah, we had to pump so much money into marketing to just gain kind of category awareness, brand awareness, to stand out, to make the product better, to build operations out. It was very, very capital intense. Yeah.
So how does the model work? So explain like how this works. You kind of broke it down nicely there in terms of unit economics. For someone who has no background in this space, how would you simply describe it to them?
Look, you choose whatever you like to eat. Quick meals, recipe, family friendly, high protein, whatever you like to eat, you choose. We've got 150 plus recipes on the menu. We then deliver the exact portions. So you still have to cook. You have no food waste. You save time. It's healthier. And then from a back end perspective, you know, we try to have as little stock as possible. As the orders come in, we place orders with our farmers, suppliers. Obviously, now we have long-term partnerships, so they have certainty. We use AI to forecast exactly what we need. And then we have these big factories that package up everything. We do some manufacturing. So, you know, we buy trucks of rice, put it through form filler machines,
no way,
churn out like packages just for you. And then you get everything you need in a box. The box is compartmentalized. There's kind of an ice department in there. You can just open up the ice. It's water. And then we send it to you wherever you live across all of Ireland, UK, Highlands, Islands, wherever you are, we'll deliver.
Highlands and Islands, wherever you are, we'll find you.
Yeah. That's the promise.
Sound like Liam Neeson. Do people sign up for like a week, a month, or what way does it work? Like if people are trying to listen and kind of going, oh, this kind of sounds interesting, I kind of give this a shot.
It's completely flexible around your needs. You know, most of our customers are kind of 35, 55 range. Young kids, competitively busy, want to eat a healthy diet, people working in technology, having no time. And so you can just order as many meals as you like, for two people, for four people. And then you don't have to buy more than 1 week. You can just try one off. It's not a hard subscription. You can pause it anytime. You can skip. Some people buy every time they have school holidays with their teachers. You know, once a quarter.
Oh, yeah.
And so I couldn't care less, right? As long
it
as
it sounds great for the customer, horrible for you.
Look, we have this like insanely loyal customer base that buys week after week after week, spending thousands of pounds with us, and they are incredibly predictable. Mm. And so that's kind of what makes the business. And then you have, you know, a smaller percentage of people who come in and out as they want.
I know what you mean. But like when I think about like the weekly shop, as we call it in Ireland, doing the big shop, I could probably do it with my eyes closed now. Because you get the same things, with the exception of like restocking a couple of things. You kind of go in, you get your pink ladies, your banana. You know, you go through the aisles, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know what you're getting, right? So I assume it's the same with you. It's like, you know, people are, we're creatures of habit. You know, we eat the same, we do the same things, we like the same things. Mm-hmm. So at what point along the journey then were you like, okay, this could be huge? Because it is a huge business. Like Gusto is massive in the UK, and I think it'll be big here as well. At what point are you like, I think this is actually going to be the one?
Probably 5-6 years into the journey. You know, I was so busy and so paranoid all day to make this better for customers every single day. And we pushed and we pushed, and all we looked at were the issues. Because, you know, that's your job, right? Got to make it better every day. But it did actually start growing really nicely. We hired some incredible talent. We managed to put automation into the operation. We managed to build data science on top. And so it started to kind of make economic sense. And so, you know, the whole unit economic stack really worked. For the first couple of years, I had to convince people, oh, if we have scale, margin will be X. And now suddenly margin was actually at a decent level. Retention was at a great level. Cost of acquisition was predictable. And so I guess like 4 to 6 years in, we started to realize like, oh, this might actually get big. The unit economics are foreshadowing profitability one day. We were still losing money. We're still raising more money, being on that treadmill. But the unit economics made sense. Every single customer who signed up was kind of profitable for us at this point. And so we knew we would build something that's at least profitable. But people challenged me hard. Even kind of 5-6 years in, people believed, you know, I mean, at best, this can be 50 million. And I tried to convince people like, no, 100 million plus. Now we're hundreds of million in revenue. There's so many doubters back then.
Are you a tech company, a food company, or both?
I think we are a data company that loves food.
Great description.
The common denominator is everyone speaks data. I want to build a meritocracy where the most junior person can push an amazing idea as long as it's grounded in data. Whether you work in food safety, health and safety, supply chain, data science, I want people to use data to make the case and fight for customers. And I want to push decision making to whoever is close to the customer, but I want them to make decisions based on the customer data, right? And so from a culture perspective, we try to build conditions for people to be their best every single day, to really empower people. But that required kind of this data mindset. We are a food business, right? I love food. I'm a foodie. I enjoy myself cooking gusto 5 times a week, as I have done for 13 years now.
And you're still not sick of it. That's a good indication.
Oh my God, it's so good. It changes your life.
If you're not watching on YouTube, well, you should be. Go and watch YouTube. Timo's got a great shirt. Health is wealth, food is medicine. I love it. Like you're living the brand. Mm. I think that's like drinking your own soup, quite literally. Like that's the greatest compliment to any founder, right? Because you're doing something for yourself also. I want to ask you something there, because you talk about the customer, the customer, the customer. There's that great line from Henry Ford. If I'd asked customers what they wanted, they would have said faster horses. You built something. There you go. You built something that was foreshadowing the future. And you mentioned foreshadowing there, which I thought was an interesting way of phrasing it. You built something that wasn't there yet. So how, because if you're too early, it's the same as being wrong. So how did you cross that chasm?
It's a great question. By the way, funny story. Back then, we asked customers, what do you want on the menu? And everyone said, oh, healthy salad. And we looked at, we put all these salads on the menu. No one would buy the salad. Everyone buys the burger, the sausage, you know, bangers and mash, all this stuff that's totally unhealthy. And so we definitely learned in the early days, 2 years in, we have to look at the data. What do people look at, you know, engage, buy, refer, rate? And so we very early on, we kind of built this funnel of rich data. And every week we had this data loop, and we would adjust the menu accordingly and build a menu that actually resonated. And so health is a great example. You know, I absolutely believe Gusto will morph into a preventative healthcare company over the next 10 years because food is medicine. But you can't tell that customers. Taste, variety, quality, freshness, that's kind of what people buy in. And so on the back end, we're trying to make it healthier and healthier and healthier, but we're not necessarily telling you. Yes, people buy into protein XL boxes, these things, but, you know, more vegetables, all these things we're kind of doing on the back end, and we're making sure taste stays the same. We can't compromise on taste. And so we're not trying to condition people to change necessarily, but we see a huge kind of opportunity to just make the back end better and benefit from that kind of, you know, the tide is rising fast.
I really like that, because you're doing the right thing, but you're not, it goes back to whatever, I've written this down, convenience without compromise, and started. Like, you're not compromising on the taste, because you know, people, that's why I asked you that question. I was like, I reckon people behind closed doors have a very different diet to what they say they do. Everyone wants to be healthy. Oh, next Monday, I'm going to go to the gym 5 times. You know, there's that kind of thing versus what they actually want. You can't build a business based on good wishes. You have to base it on data. So it's really interesting. Mm. And Preventative Health Company, love that. Talk to me a little bit more about that. What's your thoughts there?
Look, I think 45% of food in this country is ultra-processed food, right? And there are lots of studies suggesting that this takes 10 years off your life expectancy. And so the easiest thing to do for your body and longevity is to just cook from scratch and eat clean, right? Fresh farm, vegetables, meat, healthy stuff, not too much salt, no hidden sugar, no GMO stuff. If you can do that, you'll see kind of compounding benefits on your health. And so in that sense, food is medicine. If you have a thyroid issue, if you have cancer, if you want to run a marathon, whatever your like reason in life is to be healthy, food has to be 80% of, you know, your agenda. And so increasingly, I want us, you know, to play customization, personalization as a game, make it better for you and your family. Like Gusto, the menu you see on Gusto should be very different than the menu I see, because we have different needs. And so we're pushing very, very hard into personalization and customization, huge investment into automation, huge investment into data science to on a user by user basis to kind of tailor the recipes. We're doing close to 100 million recipes or dinners now every year, but at a very kind of micro personalized level to your needs. And obviously we can talk about fun stuff like, you know, stool probe and urine test, and that stuff will come, gut test. But I think that's the easy bit. That's kind of the front end application, yeah, of personalized health, whereas we're doing the back end, the heavy lifting.
Well, it's the 80-20. I like the way you phrase that, because most of it is 80-20. Most of it is like, you know, the three pillars. Did you eat correctly today? Did you sleep? Did you exercise? If you're covering off those three, life's going to be pretty good.
Yep.
People are always obsessed with the 20% though. But what supplements are you taking? But what shake are you having?
The turmeric shot.
Yeah. Like the 1%. So it's like, worry about the 1% later. Like,
yeah.
You know, professional athletes get there on 80%. Then we'll be fine. We just focus. But it's those things. Like, so I think.
But it's
right.
So boring, right? People want to have shortcuts, and that's the challenge.
Just give me the tablet. Just give me the hack. Just tell me what you're doing. I'm like working out 8 days a week, eating clean, getting sleep. And just their eyes glaze over. They're like, yeah, whatever. I think I'll just go back to eating crap. So what have you seen actually in the last 13 years? Shut this in the last 13 years. Have tastes changed over the last 13 years from what you've seen? Like how quickly is this evolution happening?
Slower than the media is hyping it up. You know, yes, veganism is a thing. Yes, people are much more focused on what they put into their body. But people still buy burgers and love sausages and all the basics. And so we don't want to dictate what people eat. We still offer burgers and sausage. We're definitely seeing kind of a rise in demand for fiber, for vegetables, for vegan dishes. People who exclusively used to buy meat dishes suddenly now have 1 to 2 veggie dishes every week. And so we're seeing that shift, but it's, you know, it's a slow one. It's not a rapid shift.
Okay. It's marginal. I think that's probably closer to what human nature is. Like, we evolve very slowly. It's like AI. People are like, AI is here. And I was like, it'll evolve slowly. Like, everything evolves slower than we think.
And the job we can do is, right, if you've never had veggie dishes that taste, right, and you think tofu is disgusting, try Gusto, right? Try one of these tofu dishes. They're absolutely delicious. The halloumi burger this week here in Ireland is, I think, the most sold dish, beating some of the shredded hoisin chicken wrap.
There you go. Go on, Ireland. Love. Getting our culture on with our halloumi. It's far from halloumi we were raised, Timo.
But you wouldn't make that without Gusto.
10 years ago in Ireland, you get some luck if you ask for a halloumi burger. They're like, nah, pal, back to London with you and your fancy notions. That's great, though. Like, because, I mean, you don't know what you don't know. If you've never tried it, how the hell can you know if it's going to be good or not? Like, and I think it's services like you where you're like, ah, sure, like I'll try it once. Mm. You try anything once. You know, it's those little additions that you kind of go, yeah. I think it's interesting though, you see one or two people a week going, oh, yeah, I'll just try one or two veggie things a week. What are the kind of cool trends that you're seeing? Like, what kind of like stuff like the Lumi Burger is the biggest selling? What other stuff you're like, that's wild? Like, because you must see some wild things stand out suddenly, kind of going, like acai, 4 years ago, 5 years ago. What? What is that? I don't know. It's like a berry? I don't know. Whereas now, like, acai bowls, I'm obsessed with them. Like, yeah. What other kind of like major things you've seen happening?
I mean, look, the biggest one is protein. People love protein. And everyone is pushing the protein trend. If we put Protein XL on the menu, we're like mind blown by how many people buy in. Women, men, doesn't matter, kids, teenagers, everyone wants more protein. That trend is huge. We're starting to see the fiber trend. So we have a range called Fiber Fix. That trend is growing really fast, but it's still like way smaller than protein. But you know, gut health is becoming a thing suddenly. You know, there's this smaller trend of brain food, which scientifically, you know, is a bit dodgy at this point, I would say. And so we're trying to be as scientific about these things as possible and not overclaim. Yeah, and veganism is kind of the slow burn compounder over time. It's growing and growing, but it's still small base.
What's massively overrated when it comes to food, and what's massively underrated from your like millions of data points?
I mean, you know, we just talked about protein. I think that will crash at some point, because the reality is, apart from the 1% of the population, people don't eat more protein. They get protein in their beans and steak and fish and whatever. And so I think that's overhyped, and we'll scientifically learn that certain demographics actually should not eat more protein because of kidney reasons, all kinds of reasons. So I think that trend will reverse at some point and burn and crash a little bit. And then eating a balanced diet, it's so unsexy, but it's the most underrated. Like, just have three of your vegetables a day, try to eat the rainbow, have lean kind of steak or meat. These things compound over time and give you 10 more years of life expectancy, but they're very unsexy and uncool. And, you know, we're trying to make it as easy as possible for you. One click, the stuff magically shows up. But I think awareness for that will grow and grow and grow from here.
Yeah. And as I get older, like, I'm just trying to remove all friction points from my life. Mm. Anywhere that there's friction that I want to do better, I just try habit stack or try make it easy. Like, my gym's routine is the same, you know, eat largely the same. I train at the same time every day. There's very specific things that I do. Aside from food, what are your non-negotiables when it comes to like a long, healthy life?
Big chunk is mindset, you know, gratefulness. I practice gratefulness every single day. I think you experience the life you focus on, right? And so it's easy to go through life on autopilot, focus on the person who makes more money, looks better, whatever. But if you can focus on gratefulness, it's hard to be angry or jealous, you know, if you focus on gratefulness. And gratefulness times perspective equals learning. And so if you can have this conditioning of being grateful every day for the small things in life, oh, I did the exercise better than yesterday, and I ate clean, or I had a great conversation with this colleague on this topic, I learned this. I think it conditions you to think differently about life, and you just experience a different, more powerful life. And so I focus a ton on just mindset. You know, what I do is hard. I've played the game on hard mode for like 13 years. And so you have to stay in the positive zone, and gratefulness is
specifically crazy. Do you have like, is that a journaling thing? Is that a meditation thing? What do you do every day?
So I failed at meditation. It works for lots of people. I think I'm too hyperactive. I do journaling every single day, you know, one page, what happened today? What am I grateful for? What are the small things? Life is the sum of the experiences you have, right? At age 95, I'm not remembering much, but I'll remember the people I worked with and the purpose I worked on, and the fun I had. And so it's very little I actually will remember at some point in my life. And I think you got to double down on these then. And so that's what I focus on, creating experiences every day with the people I love and then working on a purpose I genuinely love.
What would you love Gusto to become? You just popped that in your head there as you said 95. When you're looking back at 95 and you're like, that was my vision. I made it happen. What if when we do another episode in a couple of years, say 5-10 years time, what do you want to wish will happen? What will you make happen?
I want Gusto to be the backbone of the week. Life is crazy, right? Everyone is competitively busy. Monday to Thursday, go on autopilot. Don't compromise on you know, get convenience, but don't compromise. Let Gusto be the hack for health, the hack for busyness. We do everything for you. It's one click. We even recommend what we think you like most. One click, you go on autopilot, you churn out amazing dishes, your health gets better and better. We start to understand you better. We customize and personalize to your needs. And increasingly, we understand kind of your goals in life towards health. And we kind of fulfill and help you unlock your potential. I think in a nutshell, in 10 years, that's kind of what I want to unlock.
Mm. So you've been at this 13 years now. You've seen kind of boom, bust, boom, bust, boom, bust, right? You've been through a number of different cycles, right? At one stage, Gusto was valued at over $1 billion.
Mm.
Mentally, how have you thought about that? Because how have you like maintained this? You seem like quite a chilled, optimistic kind of character. How have you maintained that through those kind of ups and downs?
I think over time, I learned that fortunes are made in the down market. And they're collected in the up market. And so, you know, your job is to look around the corner, to stay optimistic, control the controllables, right? If you focus on stuff that's outside your control, all you do is you create anxiety. So take 2022, world crashed, took 13 years of risk on, you know, 3 weeks of risk off, cost of capital went up 50x, cost of living crisis, everyone felt bad, consumer confidence tanked. At the end of the day, the only thing we could do is obsess about the customer, obsess about cash. If we can do these two things and we create value for customers, great things will happen. And so all we did is we scaled choice. We cut lead time. We fought so hard on the cost side to not pass on the crazy inflation you saw in grocery shops. And so grocery inflation was 20%. We had 8% price inflation because we were fighting so hard to take cost out. And so customer and cash, control what you can control, stay positive, great things will happen. You know, these small changes will compound. And today I look back, you know, 3 years later, we're the biggest we've ever been. Growth is the fastest it's ever been. We're launching, you know, we're now here in Ireland. Customer satisfaction is the highest. Our value proposition is 5x better than the closest competitor. And so I genuinely feel really blessed going through these experiences. But obviously it felt hugely stressful. And I told myself, this is your masterclass in resilience. You double down on healthy eating, you know, connection with friends and family, gratefulness every single day, exercise every single day, limited sugar intake, limited meat intake, limited alcohol. And I really kind of came up with these pillars for myself and I held myself accountable. I'm still writing down an S for sugar in my diary every single day. If I eat processed sugar, bananas are okay, right? Or dates or whatever. But it really helped me and I reframed it as a massive opportunity. And I told myself, if I can lead the company, anyone can lead a company through growth. But if I can be the guy who leads this company through challenging times, economic disruption, we could do anything. And so in hindsight, it feels hugely fulfilling having worked through this pain, but obviously in the moment, extremely hard.
Yeah. And thank you for being so honest, because I think a lot of people are here now in 2025. I think a lot of people have kind of gone up in a cycle, down in a cycle, up in a cycle, and now they're on it. This feels like a real down cycle in certain industries. Like there's certain industries that have been hit at different times. It's not like 2008 where it was like all up, all down. I think certain industries are kind of on the way up now, AI, tech, certain industries are kind of having a down moment. So I think people listening will really take a lot from that. What I took from that is personal discipline. Having personal standards for excellence. So on the podcast, I talk about business, obviously, but I like to bring in if founders are tuned that way, and you very much are, Like, I believe the modern future founder has the brain in order, the body in order, and the business in order. Mind your business, mind your brain, mind your body. Mm-hmm. Like, you're able to take care of those three things. Like, you are kind of like the template, as I was pointing to like, not a lot of founders are there. A lot of founders are still obsessed in the business. So I thought it was so interesting. You're one of the first people to not say business answers. You actually give personal answers because they weave into the business.
Completely.
How you do anything is how you do everything.
Yep.
Those standards of personal excellence. I thought that was so interesting. So I think for people listening in 2025 who are going through a tough time, it mightn't be the answers you think are obvious. It might be starting with yourself.
Mm.
Even the sugar, the sleep. The
small like, stuff.
Because if you're turning up in a very stressed, anxious, anxiety-filled state, you're full of anxiety anyway, but if you're just fueling it with sugar and caffeine and carbs, and your body can't handle it.
No, it's discipline, consistency, and small change compounds into massive stuff. I always get asked, what was the one moment? What was the big breakthrough moment? But it is literally that discipline and being at this game for a long time and then obsessing about the customer, building the best team you can, and then great things will happen.
Absolutely. Talk to me a little bit about AI, because you kind of half mentioned there you've built AI models within the business. What does that do for you? Like, what role does AI play? Because I think there's a lot of hype around AI and a lot of people aren't exactly giving tangible examples. Like, people just kind of wave their hands and go, we're putting AI in the business. You're like, cool.
So,
what does that mean?
I mean, the world is crazy focused on Gen AI. The dirty reality is 95% of value from AI is plain vanilla machine learning. No one talks about machine learning, but it is kind of the foundational capability for Gen AI. And so, we have 17 AI products at Gusto, 16 are machine learning. One is kind of a transformer model, the T in GPT.
Yeah.
We do everything from routing the boxes in the factory, how they kind of move in the factory is determined by AI. How we lay out the pick surface. So, you have to imagine kind of 150 stations a box can stop at. And whether you put a tin of tomatoes on one station, 150 stations, the last station, no human can ever figure this out.
Yeah.
And so we optimize the back end. But also as a customer, we've created 7,000 recipes. We want them to be as local and seasonal as possible to delight you. And so the algorithm is kind of figuring out what do you most likely want, which recipe should go onto the menu. And then the algorithm now even tells the chefs, hey, this week we're missing an Asian burger, South Korean burger, 10-minute cook time, chicken as a main protein. And then the chefs and product developers are absolute magicians. They're amazing. They deserve so much credit, but they kind of really in a targeted way based on data develop these recipes that then fit into the menu. And there's churn prediction, there's forecasting. These algorithms have to talk to each other. So there's a lot of focus on product maturity, not just kind of modeling something cool, but actually embedding it in everything we do. And if we turn it off, customer satisfaction falls off a cliff.
That's so interesting because like so few companies are able to tell you tangibly what it's doing for them or will do for them. There's a lot of kind of like, obsessed about Gen AI, obsessed with this. Whereas it's fascinating to talk to big companies like you who it's making a fundamental difference in how they operate.
Mm.
So logistics, recipes, demand generation, churn, figuring out all that. So like you'd have to have had like teams of tens or twenties of people doing that, right? Yeah. Before
50-ish people now. Employee number 8 in the early days had a PhD in machine learning. And he taught us the importance of setting up your data lake, how you snowplow data into that data lake so you have real-time feeds. And so in a very basic way, we got the foundation right to build upon. And so we got quite lucky and he deserves all the credit for that. And then we started hiring these analysts and data scientists with PhDs who just did magical stuff. And, we saw the metrics change as a result of their work. We got addicted. And we kind of felt like, if this works, can we use data science here? And it started to work here. And so we early on kind of took more and more risk on data science. And over time, it's paid off big.
How have you learned to be a leader at different stages? Because you're very assured, like you're 13 years in, like just listen to you, you're like, you come across as very assured, as a very logical, calm character. Like, how have you learned? Because going from just an idea in your kitchen, the champagne prawn soup, to leading this massive, now global organization, how have you learned? What things have you lent on? If people are listening going, oh, I'm kind of at the early stages, but we're starting to grow. What things did you lean on?
I mean, firstly, you're very kind. I still have, you know, ups and downs, and the jury is still out if I'm a grown-up CEO or founder. But I love the privilege of being a CEO. I genuinely really enjoy this phase. I think the big difference is the founder works 100 hours and does every single job. Today, as a CEO, my job is to create conditions for people to be their best, right? There's not much I actually do. It's strategy, it's culture, it's a bit of communication, shareholders, board, whatever. Everything else is done by amazing people. And so my job is to make sure they live their best work life here at Gusto and they have the best kind of career development and growth and everything. If they succeed, I succeed. It's super simple. And so my mental model is you have to identify the winning behaviors. So the values you have, dream, deliver, care in our case. We have 9 ownership principles that underpin these 3 values. And then you got to make the winning behaviors as repeatable as possible. And that's your main job as a leader. And so, you know, I recognize people not for the what, but the how. 50% of your promotion is based on the how. How did you do that? Did you live the values? We have different expectations per value, depending on how senior you are. You know, the more senior you are, obviously we want to see you live these and role model these values across the org. If you're very junior, we want to see you use these values every day, focus on impact, you know, get stuff done, all these good things. Dream big, disagree and commit, to just name a couple of examples. We give equity. We invite people to Michelin star restaurants once a quarter, giving them awards at town halls. People do peer nominations, hundreds of nominations every quarter. People love it. There's buzz in the office. But you have to like tell people what you actually care about. Mm. So that's increasingly my job. And then obviously it's vision and strategy. How do you go from A to B and taking people to B and really kind of being that flag carrier and energizing people, being the chief energy officer, creating the buzz and making people believe that the hard thing is actually possible, celebrating small success to condition people. It's possible. We're on the right track. You know, you have a lot of cynical people. It's hard for people to see the future. Mm-hmm. And your job really is to kind of outline that future and make people believe.
There's a great Irish entrepreneur called Ray Nolan. And I was interviewing him. He's like, look, Gary, it's very simple. Set the vision, make decisions, get out of there. Yep. It was the most succinct description.
It's a way better way.
It's in my head all the time. He's like, look, it's very simple. This is in front of like 1,500 people. Everyone just kind of like nervously laughed. But he's that kind of character.
Enterprise Ireland helps to support and fund a vibrant startup ecosystem, providing supports, insights, and network connections to the most ambitious Irish startups. From expert advice to raising funding, exploring opportunities in international markets, to strategic planning, Enterprise Ireland is here to support you in those important startup moments. For more information about how Enterprise Ireland can support you on your startup journey, visit enterprise-ireland.com. Enterprise Ireland, helping Irish startups go global.
Right, we're going to do our quick fire round before we finish. What book should every founder read, or what book has made the most impact on you personally?
Die with Zero.
Ah.
Bill Perkins.
Yes.
Wow. You know, it talks about how life is the sum of your experiences, how you should optimize for net fulfillment in life, how you have health, time, or wealth at some point in your life, but most likely not all three at the same time. And your job is to kind of stack experiences accordingly. You know, if you're 90, you don't want to go skiing, or you don't want to, you know, travel across Latin America in a youth hostel. It doesn't make any sense, right? You want to have like a certain standard of hotel. And so your job is to sequence these experiences and stop obsessing too much about money and really think about what are the experiences that create Memory Dividends. I love that book. I've read it a couple of times. I'm rereading it right now. It's on Audible. You know, I'm listening to his voice. Like, he's such a great way of describing it.
I think that's only the second time maybe it's been recommended. I haven't read it yet.
Real treat. Only 5 hours listening. It's pretty.
Do you listen or read or both?
I listen. Do you listen? I do both, but mainly listen.
Okay. What's your superpower?
Ooh, kindness, people, seeing the vision and the big picture and getting people behind that. Consistency, discipline, high standards.
Superpowers.
I have a lot of flaws. That list is long. If you want to go there.
Usually when I ask an Irish person, they're like, oh, I don't think I have any. The cynical nature of the Irish. What's the daily habit that's the secret to your success?
Look, I mentioned gratefulness, but it is the biggest unlock. I mean, I exercise every day. I eat as clean as possible. I don't drink alcohol. But gratefulness and conditioning yourself to be grateful for all the stuff that's happening in your life just changes your perspective. As I said, you experience the life you focus on. If you're grateful, you can't be grumpy. And so that really has helped me the most.
I'm going to take that away with me. I love the mindset and I love like just things I can focus on. Like, get the life you focus on. I think that's just, it's powerful. What entrepreneur should everyone be following in 2025?
I think the number one skill that's underrated is kindness and compassion. You know, we live in a world where we see a ton of entrepreneurs burn and crash and do crazy stuff at scale, the Elon Musks of this world. And I genuinely think we need more role models who are kind and caring. You know, this Michael Flynn guy, the mattress Mick, here in Ireland. But he's a great example, right? He's a genuinely kind and caring guy. He's such a character.
That was not a reference I thought you were going to make today, Timo.
Well, I want to, you know, the easy answer is, oh, look at this Gen AI leader, right? But take people like him. He's genuinely kind. He donates X% of his salary. He's done this like for a long, long, long time. The world needs more kind of authentic people.
I agree with you. I think the role models are skewed. People look at the 1% and assume that's how you should live. It's not.
The cool tech bro.
It's bananas. People model their behaviors off, role models. I agree with you. We need a lot of new role models. That's kind of why I've actually started asking that question, because it's only a new question and it is something I want to actually start giving people, because again, see it to be it. That's the hill I will die on. You need people to be able to follow and go, look at Timo, look at Gary, look whoever. I'm going to give you 1 million euro. I'll give you sterling, actually. Do better. You can invest in one person or one company. Who is it?
Anything that's at the intersection of Gen AI and health, anything that's, you know, any leader who's kind and compassionate and sees purpose. For example, you know, the lady who runs Canva, amazing company, you know, democratizing design, leveraging AI, 100 million users on the platform now. AI will power and power and power that business. She's so purposeful. She's so kind and caring and thinking about, you know, being very intentional on the journey. I'd put my money into somebody like her.
Cool. If you were starting again from zero in 2025.
Health. AI, health, that intersection.
Okay.
I'd start Gusto again. I feel so privileged to be where I am. And the next 10 years will be amazing.
What do you believe that other people would find strange or strongly disagree with you on?
I don't focus on money. I focus on time. You know, I'm awake 16 hours a day, probably a bit more, times 60 minutes. That's 1,000 minutes I get to spend every day. You've got 1,000 minutes to invest. I've got 1,000 minutes to invest. And so how do you really condition yourself to optimize for time in life and memory dividends, which memories are compounding over time? Some of them actually get bigger over time, right? In your mind, which ones are these and how do you build them into your life, especially if you work, you know, still very long hours? And so return on time kind of investment rather than financials as such.
That brings us nicely onto our next two questions. What's been your worst investment?
I dabbled in call options, as one does, highly not recommended. You know, I bought call options on shares twice, you know, 15 years ago, and I got lucky and I started to think I'm really good at this game. somebody even offered me money. Do you want to manage my money? And I mean, luckily I didn't take it, luckily, but it's easy to believe your own hype when you're young. And then the third time I lost everything, and it was such a good lesson. I'm so glad I lost it all because it made no sense. I mean, it's literally gambling, but great, great experience.
Someone told me that they're like, the most dangerous thing in the world is a first time founder that gets it right first time.
For sure. You learn nothing, right?
Yeah.
The harder the times,
then you think you have the magic wand for everything, for every industry, every sector. What's been your best investment?
By the way, I think if you don't fail a couple of times, you're not pushing, you're not accepting enough risk in your life. You gotta seek failure. People look down on people who fail, but you need to seek risk.
Experiment, set the parameters. Don't go, oh, this'll sink me forever if I do it. Have parameters. People think entrepreneurs are these mad risk takers. They are, but in a very controlled environment, because you know you can't bet the farm, because if you bet the farm and it goes wrong, people's lives are, you know, at risk in terms of their wages and their salaries and their families. So you're controlled risk takers.
Love that. And look, I mean, it's all about asymmetric risk, right? Can you use like 10 units of your time or 10% of your time or whatever it is, or your money, to see if you can achieve it 1,000x or 10,000x outcome? And if it doesn't work, cut the losses, shut it down, stop it, move on, take the next risk, do three of them. Don't go all in, don't bet the house. I mean, obviously, if it works, bet the house at some point.
Yeah.
You have to, but be very disciplined about risk taking. Best investment? Since I was 15, I'm now 40, I've spent 4,000 hours on fitness. Single best investment of my life, like time investment, right? 4,000 hours, probably a bit more. I'm exercising hard, you know, 4 hours a day times 52 weeks times a bunch of years. That's 4,000 hours invested in fitness. Makes me mentally strong, sets me up for the day, teaches you resilience. If you can hit the gym at 6 a.m. in the morning, killing yourself, lying on the floor, nothing else feels that difficult that day, right? And it's about conditioning yourself to be the best.
I was on the floor this morning, literally at 6:30. I'm right there with you, Timo. It's, nice, I agree. Nice. I 100%. And you're doing your first Hyrox soon, which will be huge.
I'm excited. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, I could have told you Gusto is the best investment ever, which is true. But
I like when people give me new answers, though. You kind of have to assume, yeah, of course, it's your best investment. Speaking of advice, right? What's the one piece of advice or insight or action you want people to take after listening to you today?
Focus on the customer. Obsess about the best team you can possibly build, you know, and then manage yourself and be the best version you can possibly be, not somebody else. Don't look over the fence. Grass is always greener. The grass is greenest where you water the grass, right? Like, take care of yourself and then do these two things, customer and team. Great things will happen.
Love it. Comparison is the thief of joy, as they say. Completely. I love it. Water your own garden. Where can people, number one, learn more about you, and number two, sign up for Gusto?
Go to Gusto. You know, just Google Gusto, G-O-U-S-T-O, sign up, give it a go, send me a message. I'm on LinkedIn, you know, email us, our customer service. They will forward this to me. I love customer feedback, right? Be critical. I hope you love it as much as I do. Hopefully it changes your life for the better. But yeah, give it a go. And then, you know, we're on social media, Instagram, TikTok, all these things. But give it a go. It's fun.
Brilliant. Welcome to Ireland. It's great to have you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Massive privilege. Thank you.